Welcome to another episode of Sonship Podcast with me, John McDonald. I'm your host, of course, and I have a brilliant guest today, someone I've known for a long time, an incredibly interesting life. I'm sure you'll love her. Please say a big welcome to Marisa Rosie. Marisa, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me, John.
No, not at all. I've always found you a very interesting person, so it's great to get you on record.
I know, yeah, absolutely.
So obviously, you're Scottish, same as me.
I am, yep.
But so where did you grow up, Marisa?
So I grew up in Stirling, so born and bred in Stirling. Okay. Dad's from Stirling, mum was from Glasgow. So I'm back living in Stirling, having, you know, been away and round the world and back again.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that.
I am back in Stirling now, sort of only about a 10-minute walk, actually, from my childhood home. So I'm back to my roots.
But growing up, childhood for you was quite difficult because you have an eye condition, don't you?
I wasn't diagnosed until
you were a little bit older.
So I was diagnosed when I was seven, actually, just from a very kind of astute primary school teacher, actually, who noticed that I wasn't properly seeing the blackboard as it was in those days with the chalk, and I was missing sort of the edges of maybe sums, like threes and eights and ones and sevens, and I would kind of write them down and get the sum correct in my jotter, but I wasn't correctly kind of writing them from the board.
But it was the wrong sum.
It was the wrong sum, yeah, right answer, wrong sum, you know. Yeah, it's a bit like Morco and Wise, you know, all the right numbers, but not necessarily in the right order.
must have been incredibly frustrating for you, even as a young child, to have all of that happening to you and not knowing what's wrong.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose I wasn't terribly aware at first because, the problem that I have, it affects my peripheral vision. So I've got kind of tunnel vision. So, I mean, I suppose you only know what you know. So I just assumed that everybody just saw straight ahead. I didn't realise that people actually could see a sort of wider range of visual field. I never really knew that I was particularly different, certainly at a young age, because I just assumed that was how people saw. I could still play, you know, things I can't do now, like ball games, like play tennis and things like that. So I still had some visual field because the eye condition is obviously degenerative. So it kind of progressively gets worse as you get older. Wow. So that was from the age of seven. So this teacher kind of just picked up something. So I kind of ended up going to eye hospital through in Glasgow, first in Stirling, then through in Glasgow for specialists. And they diagnosed a relatively rare eye condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which basically means there's like spots on the back of the eye and the retina, which affect the kind of light sensing part of your eye. Wow. So there's various things like that affects your peripheral vision, so you have tunnel vision. Or actually, to be honest, tunnel vision, it's more like funnel vision because it's kind of narrow here, but the further you go away, the kind of slightly wider it gets. So I think funnel is better than tunnel, to be honest.
So that's congenital then? It took 7 years to discover it.
Yeah, I mean, that's to amazing. Be honest, that's fairly young to get diagnosed. I mean, a lot of people with my eye condition can go through until adult life and not get diagnosed. Wow. Quite often, I mean, I think because your sight can be, you know, reasonably okay when you're a child, and then it gets slightly worse as you get older. The other thing, as I got older, I mean, actually when I was about 20-ish, it was cataracts. You get very early onset cataracts with it. Wow. So I've had cataract surgery probably when I was in my 30s, I think. Yeah, it must be in the 30s.
Wow.
So very young to have cataract surgery.
Yeah, it's very young.
Yeah, but that's another kind of symptom of the eye condition that I have. Okay. I mean, things have progressed more because I actually, kind of long story short, kind of turned out to be a much more complicated. Not only I have a rare condition, I've got the rarest of the rare.
You've just got to be different, haven't you?
Well, I know, absolutely. So
you're growing up with this condition, you're trying to live a normal life, and where does faith come into all of that? Because obviously you came into a belief in Jesus and all of that. Is that from family or something outside of family?
Well, it was outside of family. Can I go back just two steps?
Sure.
Because when I was a child, one of the things was, because this is kind of, it's quite central to my kind of my story, really. There's never been anything they could do. And obviously, it was just my eyesight at the time. And there was nothing the doctors or anything could do. So the doctors here were saying, well, we don't really know. You might be blind by the time you're an adult. We have no idea. But my mum researched a lot of things, and she found this kind of quite experimental, not approved at all by the British Medical Association's treatment in Switzerland. Mm. And so I spent my childhood actually going to Switzerland from the age of 7 through to the age of 15. I was, we'd spend 3 weeks in an eye clinic, and I would get injections in my eyes. Mm. With very little anaesthetic. So that had a major impact, just major trauma on my life.
Oh, yeah.
Major trauma that just has affected me in terms of my, well, in all sorts of ways. And yeah, so I think I was quite, by the time I got to my teenage years, I was really struggling, just emotionally and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think looking back, you know, there was kind of mental health stuff going on there just as a result of the trauma from this treatment that I was kind of going through for 3 weeks every year in Switzerland.
Wow.
So, yeah. So then in terms of faith, I mean, I grew up going to Church Scotland. My dad and my gran would take me. My mum was Roman Catholic. My dad was Protestant. So when they got married, obviously, you know, the kind of the whole, she was Glasgow and, you know, the two would never kind of meet. And so there was a lot of family kind of division and kind of fallouts a little bit with my mum and dad's marriage and things. So she got on fine with her mum and her sister, which had a half brother who just wouldn't accept it. So there was all that kind of thing. So my mum left the Catholic Church but didn't really go to the Protestant Church. So I kind of grew up going to Church Scotland with my dad and my gran until sort of my teenage years. And then I met a friend at school and we got friendly, and she had gone along to the Baptist Church and had a good kind of evening service with fellowship, that kind of thing. And so she invited me to that. And it's one of these things, she invited me and she said, oh, you've got to come. And I said, oh, no, I don't want to come. You know, I'm not interested. Because I was kind of like, not really interested in church. But that time I was like 16 years old and I'm just a bit boring, you know, the kind of hymn prayer language at church.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, like, why do you want to go there? So then she said, oh, there's a baptism service. Why don't you come along? And I was like, why would I want to go and see babies getting water sprinkled on their heads? Because that was the only thing I thought of, was baptism in the Protestant church. Oh no, it's adult. So I was like, this just sounds too weird. You know, it was like, really? So I went out of just out of sheer curiosity at this weird kind of bizarre thing that was happening at the Baptist church, so that people were going to actually go like dunked completely underwater, and in those days they were all dressed in white robes, so it was even weirder, you know. But so I went along and I was like, what is this, you know? But the music was good and there was quite a lot of young people there, and then I kind of my gran had passed away by that time, and just over the weeks I started going every week, so I was kind of, there's something different here, do you know, just, well, there was a different flavor. And and then it turned out that my gran used to go, and I didn't even know she'd gone to the Baptist church in the evenings, but a lot of the older people in the church said, oh, we know your granny, we knew grandfather. And I'd never known my grandfather because he died before I was born. And oh yeah, they started up this youth thing when they were in the 50s, and they had all this history, and I was like, I never knew anything.
Wow.
I just got a really nice welcome, and so I started going along there, and it was kind of just over, so my last year at high school, sort of sixth year, and just week by week, just different things would strike me, and I'm thinking, okay, I haven't heard that about God before, and who is this God? And started asking questions, and my friend she had become a Christian during the previous summer, and so just kind of, we'd have all these discussions and stuff at school, and so just kind of slowly over that course of the year. And then towards the end of the school year, about June, they had just a visiting speaker who came, did your kind of traditional altar call, anybody who wants to become a Christian, stand up. And it was one of those things, the Holy Spirit was just talking to me. And I was like, stand up. No, I'm not going to stand up. No, it's too much. No. And then I was like, no, I can't do this. And then I kind of was like, right, God, if the person next to me stands up, I'll stand up. But I'm not standing up otherwise, because I'll be like stupid standing up all by myself. And then what happens? The person next to me stood up. So I was like, right, okay. So that's, I stood up. I wasn't really sure what I was doing, but I just knew there was something. Something was changing in my heart. And there was some kind of knowledge of God kind of and Jesus at that stage. So yeah. So I would say that was when I kind of sort of made that first kind of commitment myself. Yes, and I was 17 at the time.
Wow. So how did you go from that to being a missionary going all over the world?
Yeah, well, it happened really quickly because so I was in my last year at school. So I finished school on the Friday, started work as a nanny on the Monday for the summer holidays, and then was going to go off to drama school, actually, become a famous actress and, you know, get my Oscar and all the rest of it.
I could imagine you doing that, actually. I think I would. That would have suited you.
Yeah, I know. I had my Oscar speech all written and everything, you know. You know, people used to sing into their hairbrushes. I would like practice my Oscar speech and my hairbrush and my bedroom. You know. So So that summer, a YWAM team came to my church, and I was helping out with. There was a youth kind of group.
Just for those listening who might not know. YWAM.
Youth with the Mission. So a mission organisation that started in the 60s. I think kind of getting young people into missions, because used to be, you know, you have to go through Bible college and be a doctor or a teacher or something, and it was kind of like a vision to actually mobilize lots of young people into sort of short-term trips and things initially. So this team came, it was actually Commonwealth Games, actually, I think in Edinburgh maybe. And there was a team there, to be 86, so from my age now, yeah. And so they came to my church after they'd done some kind of outreach thing at the Commonwealth Games, and they did 2 weeks, and they were doing street theatre. So of course I was really into drama, so I was like, oh, this is really cool. Maybe I can use my drama and, you know, God's thing, you know, maybe they go together, actually. So I had really good fun couple of weeks with them. And then I went off and did a kind of year, just HNC in sort of communication media studies, because I wasn't really sure what to do. But then I thought, well, maybe, during the week that I read, Keith Green had written a thing, Why You Should Go on the Mission Field. And of course, he was big, you know, he died by that time, but his music was obviously the kind of big Christian music of the time and stuff. So, he was kind of one of the first Christian artists, I suppose, I listened to. And he had sort of written this thing, Why You Should Go on the Mission Field. And it was like, maybe I should go on the mission field. Maybe I should be a missionary. How do you become a missionary? I don't know how you become a missionary. And there was this YWAM team there. And I was like, well, can I go there? But I thought, maybe I should need to get training. So I actually applied for Bible college. And went to Glasgow Bible College, which was the Bible Training Institute at the time, became Glasgow Bible College and then International Christian College. So I went there the following year. And then during the sort of 3 years, I was 3 years there, did a diploma in theology. And kind of a couple of things that happened. Of course, there was all these people who were like going off to become missionaries or trained to be pastors or whatever. And I was like, I don't know. Where am I supposed to go? What do I do with this? You know, and you know, oh, I'm called to Thailand or I'm called to India, and I was like, I don't know. So I thought, well, where do I go? You know, I thought, well, I fancy China. You know, just I don't know why, but why not? You know, want to travel? Let's just pick a country. So we had to go to one of the things we had to do was join a prayer group. So I joined the one for the Far East, and during that time, I got to kind of just hear about different places in Asia, I suppose. And the place that struck me the most was Cambodia. The killing fields had happened, the Vietnam War had happened in that whole region. And it was kind of when I was, you know, in the 70s. So it kind of passed me by as a child. But I kind of started reading up on this. And the more I read up on it, the more I kind of felt just a kind of compassion towards that part of the world. Lo and behold, another YWAM team arrived, this time on the Anastasis, which was like one of the ships that kind of sail around the world, and you know, they do medical stuff and various things in places. And it docked in Glasgow, and I was going to Victory Christian Fellowship at the time, and they came and did South Sea Island Breeze drama team came and did these sort of South Sea Island kind of Christian dancey drama things. And I was like, oh, dancing drama again. And And so they told me that there was a thing in Asia with YWAM called Far East Evangelism Teams, and it was using dance and drama in Asia. So I thought, why not? Sounds like a plan. So that's how I ended up in YWAM and in Asia.
Wow.
Yeah. So, following year, I ended up in Hong Kong initially, and then we went traveling around with this team.
Yeah. So you obviously didn't spend the whole of your life as a missionary just dancing.
No.
What else did they have you doing?
The first thing was like 6 months, and then so I spent 6 months in Asia traveling around doing dance and drama through evangelism and stuff in sort of Thailand, India, and Nepal. Came back, I did what's called a discipleship training school, which is the YWAM training school, which lasts 6 months. So did that, and then very quickly headed back out to Asia, because that by that time I really had a heart for refugees. So I ended up going back to Thailand. The refugee camps, amazingly, were still open from the 70s, you know, from the Vietnam War, the Cambodian killing fields. There were still camps in Thailand. So I ended up back there. And I mean, that was just a kind of miraculous thing. I was about to leave, didn't know what to do. And a fax those days came in and said, we need somebody to come within the next 6 weeks to kind of cover some missionaries who are going away on sort of home leave. It's somebody who would be interested in coming out to Thailand to work in the camps. So I was like, right, I'm going. So within 6 weeks, I was in Thailand again.
Wow.
Working in the camps.
So what was it about Asia that drew you, Melissa?
I don't know. I mean, I always had a heart. I always wanted to travel. Do you know, I think I always said my mum spent 7 years in Brazil. So she really kind of instilled the kind of, and then traveled around the world and stuff. So, she really instilled the kind of love for cultures and different places and languages and stuff like that. And I think maybe my slightly rebellious part of me decided that I wanted to go the opposite direction from my mum. So she went to South Asia. I went the opposite direction, went east to Asia. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's something about the culture I loved. And I think I think I've always had I suppose in those days as well, the kind of we kind of said this at Bible College, you know, it's like whatever you don't want to go, that's where God's definitely going to send you.
Oh,
you know?
I've heard that one, so, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you know, what's going to be the worst place in the planet, you know? And actually, my worst place was actually India, and my best place was going to be Thailand. And when I got to Asia at first, and we had to decide what team we were going to go on, and I really wanted to go to Thailand, but I'm like, there's no way I'm going to India. But there was two teams, we had to choose between one or two. And one was going to the Philippines and China and Taiwan. And the other team was going to Thailand and India. And I was like, oh, trust that. That's just God, you know. He's going to make you go to the place you don't want to go. But, you know, that was kind of like a mission. Yeah. It's not difficult and killing you. It's not real missionary work. So, yeah, I suppose that's a bit of a wrong belief that we've had over the years.
I know, but yeah, I know.
That was, you know, that's kind of that's what kind of was the thing, you know, okay, where's God going to send me? That's going to be horrible. And, I love Thailand, the food and the culture and the people. And I like
Were you teaching there, or were you just doing relief work, or what kind of work were you actually doing?
Oh, yeah. So when I got there, the team leader was from New Zealand. And I mean, the camps had been there for such a long time. They were kind of like small towns. They had everything a town had: school, post office, bank. There was a clothing factory. There was a kind of a knitting factory. Although it sounds like crazy making warm clothes, but it was for refugees that were then going to kind of go and live in other countries that maybe were colder. Yeah. So they would get given, you know, we were teaching them skills, and there was like factories and stuff, and they would work in them, and then they would get clothes as clothing packages and stuff. So when I got there, my team leader said, I've put you to be the manager of the knitting factory because you're Scottish, so you'll know how to knit. I've never knitted a thing in my life. I don't know how to knit. So the Vietnamese had to teach me how to knit, because I was working with Vietnamese at that time. I don't knit, you know, not. And then I worked in the sewing thing. Fortunately, they all had skills, so it was just more of a management job and stuff. But I'm like, it was just quite funny that she thought I could knit because I was Scottish.
Because you were Scottish. Oh my goodness.
So, yeah.
How did you afford to do that then? Did Did you have people supporting you? Did you earn money from YWAM?
Yeah, so no, we don't earn money with YWAM. You're a missionary, John. They don't pay you money. In fact, you have to pay them money to actually for the privilege of being.
Oh my goodness. Seriously?
Seriously. So you have to pay all your own way and everything. So yeah, no, at that stage, I mean, fortunately, it was in Thailand. It was quite cheap to live. So it wasn't too much then. But yeah, I mean, I had to kind of basically live by faith. And I had a church back home that supported me, and then some individuals. That's really just the only way to live. And actually, I mean, YWAM has a rule that you're not allowed to earn money.
Wow.
You're not actually allowed to. I mean, I have to say, I broke the rule later on. Don't tell Lauren Cunningham.
Seriously,
you're not allowed to have any paid employment.
Why?
Oh, because you're not living by faith then.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, I know.
But I guess, especially when we're younger, we buy into all of that stuff, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we do. I mean, as I got older, I thought, we didn't. And actually, as I got older, I thought, you know what, I need a bit of extra cash and stuff. Yeah. And so I did take on the odd extra job. But then you end up working like crazy hours, like workaholism, because you're supposed to be full time with, missionary. And full time is not 9 to 5. Full time is like 24/7, so you're totally workaholic. And then if you're not kind of making ends meet, then you're thinking, well, maybe I should take an extra job on. And so, I mean, I worked in, obviously in your neck of the woods, actually, eventually in Seamill. The YWAM base up there. So then when I came back from Asia, eventually I went into training, the training department there, and was training people to go out to Asia or other places as well, but particularly Asia. At one point I was like, yeah, I need to get a job. And there was, in the Hydro Hotel, they've got a wee gift shop. And the lady there was looking for somebody just to kind of man it sort of 3 times a day. So I'd go in before breakfast to get, sell the newspapers for the morning. And then I would come up, do my YWAM bit, run down at lunchtime, do another hour or something, run back up to YWAM, run back down. Sometimes, not necessarily 3 times a day, but sometimes do the evening shift or something. So it's just crazy. And then when I moved over to Stirling, eventually I had a YWAM team over here. And I mean, I did a bit, not much, just kind of once a year or so, but I did invigilating at the high school for the exams and things. So just to kind of get a wee bit of cash sometimes.
So I'm interested to explore this whole thing, because obviously they're quite tight about how you should live and what you should and shouldn't do. I mean, how did you find that restrictive in other ways apart from the finances?
I think looking back now, yes. I mean, I suppose like you were saying, at the time you just buy into it, this is normal. I would sometimes meet, people in churches and stuff, and they would kind of look at YWAM and think, do you live this kind of weird way? And we would think, no, we don't, it's just normal. Do you know, it's normal for us. But yeah, looking back from the outside now and from what I can see now, I'm thinking, yeah, there was some strange things that, now, I think it is very restrictive. This is my big thing, which kind of feeds into kind of more of my story of my trauma and stuff. And I mean, sure, you'll relate to this, and probably others can too, especially in sort of the kind of the charismatic kind of movement and sort of healing time, and certainly when the whole Toronto thing was happening, and there was just all that kind of sort of revival and stuff that was going on. And that kind of, it touched YWAM. A lot of our leaders went over to Toronto and came back carrying the blessing and stuff. A lot of emphasis on healing and deliverance. And when they came back from Toronto particularly, so, and it kind of helped. It was, they would have these kind of meetings and obviously people would kind of get in touch by the Holy Spirit, and there'd be this, things where people are all, all these demons coming out of them and all this kind of stuff. And at the time you just accepted that was what was happening. Now I look back on it and I think, I don't think it was that at all. I don't think it was demons. I mean, I don't dispute the reality of demons, but I think a lot of it is trauma.
Yes. That's what I was going to say.
And I think trauma was a major thing, and people were almost misdiagnosing it in Christian circles. And then you wonder why you don't get better. You'd wonder why, demons cast at you 1 week and then next week they're still there. But it, you know, you're still feeling that pain and that agony and all the rest of it. And
that's
I think that's
interesting. I just want to park there for a minute, because this whole idea, because what's happening is the person is being re-traumatized each time.
Exactly, yeah.
It's been it's been triggered every time.
Yeah, wow, absolutely.
That's so damaging.
Yeah, and I think only as I've now, I think only just really in the last, I mean, the father's love's been about a big part of kind of unraveling all of that for me, and also going into some therapy as well. And I very purposely chose a non-Christian, quite anti-church therapist, because I wanted to be able to unpack a lot of the stuff that I didn't feel maybe comfortable talking to a Christian with, because I'm not, I want to know what their reaction would be. And I want, you know, to kind of, you know, have someone else's very, you know, professional opinion. And I think that was very damaging. And I think the other thing that was, I think, damaging as well, is that it wasn't really kind of seen as acceptable to almost get mental health help from outside. It was always done in-house, and I definitely needed it by that stage. I mean, by that stage, I would say I had an eating disorder. I had lost a lot of weight. I had my very first kind of serious panic attack. And I was referred, I went to the doctor, but they didn't really do very much. I just kind of saw a nurse once a week, but everything was, oh, no, why one will deal with it. You know, we'll do prayer ministry with you. We'll do this with you, you know, and... And, you know, and I wondered for many years, why do I keep going back to the same thing? Why do I never feel free of this? Why is it going round and round and round? And it's like you say, it's just being re-traumatized all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think only in the last sort of maybe 6 or 7 years, I've kind of began to unravel that and actually kind of put a name to it. No, it wasn't demonic. It was trauma. And, you know, I could say that from my childhood, from the eye treatment. Yeah. Had and all of that hadn't been dealt with.
So was it additional trauma, or was it just the trauma from childhood that was being triggered all the time, or was there other stuff being piled on you that was traumatizing you during those years?
I think actually, again, looking back, I mean, there was things that I wouldn't say there was traumatizing, but there was things that I was starting to feel uncomfortable within YWAM, even when I was in the midst of it. And I think a lot of it was the kind of a lot of the pressure. I started working for what's called the Frontier Missions Centre. And there was a huge emphasis within YWAM at the time on focusing on the least evangelized people in the world. So you're talking about, you know, the poorest, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Muslim, right across what they call the 1040 windows. It's kind of from the Middle East across India into Asia. And so there was a big push to kind of, that's where everybody needs to go. And again, it's this whole thing of, if it's not hard, if it's not the worst place in the world, if it's not the poorest, then you're not really reaching it. And there was a lot of guilt and I think condemnation. And I remember having a conversation with my boss at the time, my line leader. And we would go to all these things like clan gathering, we'd go to Christian conferences and we'd have our stand, we'd be recruiting people, and I was never comfortable with it. It felt pressurizing, you know. And then my boss would say, oh, can you phone these people up? Can you phone, like it's almost like cold calling people and calling it Christian stuff, you know. And it felt very uncomfortable to me and I never liked it. And then people would come and they would say, oh, you know, I want to go into missions and I want to go and work with the street kids in Brazil. And my bosses would say, oh, no. The street kids in Brazil, no, they've got plenty of people going to them. You need to go to, not the street kids in Brazil, not the street kids in Romania. You need to go to the street kids in India or Pakistan or this place because they don't have anybody there, you know. And there was a lot of pressure to say, no, you haven't heard from God, to go here. You need to go where it's really hard, where people are. And I never felt comfortable with it. It felt like a massive guilt trip, and it's almost like, you know, if you don't go, if you don't tell these people, they might all go to hell and it might be your fault. So
I don't mean it cruelly or and it may have been unintentional, but it's quite manipulative.
I think so,
you know. And I say I don't believe that people deliberately try to manipulate or control others, but that's what the system creates.
Yeah.
It creates manipulation and control through guilt.
Yeah. And I mean, I've had, I think in the last few years, I mean, I think I've, through going to my therapist and also, my pastor actually now, I've moved churches, I left my old church, moved to, I go to the Baptist Church in Stirling, and my pastor there, who's now retired, but I got on just so well with him in the last year or so. And as I was talking to him, he was probably a lot of mistrust, I think, in Christian leaders over a number of years for lots of different reasons. And that's kind of just starting to rebuild now, I think. And my pastor, Ryan, he was really fundamental and kind of helped me to build trust. And when I was telling him all this kind of stuff, and also talked to my therapist, I didn't want to use the word, but they very quickly said to me, "Marisa, spiritual abuse."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, comfortable, you know. But the more I thought about it, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, and like you say, it's not maybe intentional. And people probably do it with the best of intentions and with a heart of, you know, of what they know and of what they experience. But I think, you know, it's like what you're saying, it's the whole church system has created this.
Yeah.
And I think it has been damaging for a lot of people.
Yeah.
In different ways. So, yeah.
And a lot of the therapy world is now beginning to recognize, not just from Christianity, but from other religions, that there is a syndrome of religious trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, RTS, religious trauma syndrome. And yeah, like, the sociologists are talking about it, the therapists are talking about it. And that's quite frightening that this is just really coming into the public domain. How many people are there who have been out in the mission fields or been in churches where that's been their experience? And they think, you know, because when you start to kick against that, you're a rebel, you're ungodly, yeah, you're sinning, you're backsliding, you're demonized.
The whole thing as well is, you know, there's a lot of pressure. You respect your leaders, you honor your leaders. You know, you don't kind of really say anything against them because, again, you know, that's, you know, that's gossip, it's slander, it's this, it's that, it's sin. But, you know, one of the things, I mean, both Brian is a pastor and my therapist has said, you know, if you don't call it out, it's just going to continue. And sometimes, you know, you do have to, and I have had to do that. And I mean, that involved me walking away from YWAM. It involved me walking away from the church that I was in and actually walking away from ministry entirely because I was pretty broken by it. I was burnt out by it. I was, very hurt by it as well. And it's taken a lot to kind of rebuild it. And again, it's not like anything like intentional, and a lot of people that I love dearly who are still in that kind of that, you know, that mentality and still within that, you know, that missionary system and still doing all the things I did. And probably if they hear me speak now, they probably would say, "Oh, Marisa's gone way off." She's so liberal now.
You're such a progressive.
I'm so progressive. I know, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and I have had I've probably lost friends over it, you know, over some of my new thinking, shall we say?
Yeah.
Progressive thinking, because other people are just like, no.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I mean, one part of my journey, and I think either with just like with Father's love and stuff, I've kind of got to a stage where I'm thinking, you know what? I'm starting to feel comfortable enough in my own skin that I will sort of say, no, this is not right. And I have, even not that long ago, confronted somebody over something that they did that was bang out of order, that was, I thought, was spiritual abuse, and they did it publicly and it needed addressing. And I thought, gosh, I wouldn't have done that a few years ago. I would have just slunk away quietly. But yeah.
Well, there's been some healing then, eh?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That's awesome. So how did you come through that burnout and that kind of falling apart, really? How did you come through that and begin to rebuild? Obviously therapy, but
yeah,
because you still have a faith, you still believe in God, and for a lot of people, they come through that and it falls apart and they say, well, you know, two fingers up to God.
Yeah,
if that's what he's like, then I don't want anything to do with it. So how have you managed to maintain some sort of faith?
I think part of me has always managed to get the difference between God and church. Mm. And I think that was kind of what I was kind of, evaluating. Okay, is this God or is this church? And mm-hmm. if it's church, it's more what man has made church to become rather than what God has been. And I think part of the good thing is that I experienced the Father's love before I kind of fell apart. So I kind of had that foundation of just knowing his love. And whilst I'm still sort of in the system and in many ways kind of still kind of unraveling it a little bit. So I think sort of the first sort of few years of being kind of really experiencing the Father's love, I actually went up to friends Heather and David Johnson, and they had a ministry, and I went up to their house for a retreat because I was still working while, but I was burnt out, and that would be oh gosh, my goodness, it was actually 16 years ago, and it was I know Thank that because it was the year my nephew was born, and he's just about to turn 16, really? So yeah,
wow.
So I went up for a retreat, just completely burnt out, and they were living up near the Isle of Skye, went up for a few days, and they just ministered to me for a few days, and I had a tangible experience that they had a little prayer room at the back, and I went in there just in the last night, and I sat in that room just myself, a little bit of instrumental music playing. Heather left me alone, and all I can say is I had an experience of God that I'd never had before, and that was my first, I would say, experience of the love of the Father. It was like God took the roof off the house, and he just started pouring love in, like liquid love, and it just filled the whole room. And I just, it felt like it was coming down my head. It just felt tangibly loved.
Wow.
And that was, I was like, wow. And something shifted then. That was the start of the shifting. I think it was just an experience that I still think, wow, that was probably one of the most profound experiences of God in my life that I'd had. And I'd been fishing for over 20 years by that time. Wow. And so that kind of started developing, and I think then I went to A school with Dollar Heart Ministries. I went over to Holland, did that there. Went and did the B school, as we've all done, many of us down in Hempstead. Went and then just started anytime there was anything that was remotely Father's love. Weekends. I mean, I remember going on with you, with Trevor, and you and I, and we went around and did stuff. And then obviously the monthly gathering, and schools in Larbert, and the Tron, and anything. So I mean, I was hungry for more, because once you started kind of, there's something here that we're touching into that's not in church, and it wasn't. I mean, it was kind of in YWAM. I mean, YWAM said, the Father's love, and they had we have a week of teaching on it at our schools, and Floyd McClung kind of knew Jack Winter, and there was the connection there and all that kind of stuff. And so there was an aspect of it within YWAM, but it became just one other teaching within a bunch of like 12 weeks of teaching. Yeah. So you kind of thought you knew it, but you didn't really, I think, is what it's in YWAM. You had the basic teaching, but it was just one of many things. So it didn't really go as deep as I think certainly I started to experience once I started to be involved in Father's love in various other ministries and stuff.
Yeah.
But I was still in YWAM, so I still had that kind of workaholic kind of thing. So I was still ministering Father's love now and then. So that took a bit of unraveling, Just kind of, okay, let's just a few years to experiencing it, but then still kind of having that the same kind of I've got to almost not work to earn God's love, but if I don't, maybe it'll stop.
There's always that element of like I want to keep him pleased, isn't there? I want him to be pleased with me.
I know. So there was that going on as well, and then I think I think what the kind of when I got to about, when I had the flu and then I had these sort of weird symptoms, I had like just one thing after another happen. Started, my health was having issues. then my dad died, then we were looking after my mum, then my mum died, then my church in the middle of this decided that they weren't going to support me anymore, and there was lots of issues going on there, and I eventually just had enough and I left church. So then, because I had no support, I kind of left YWAM, and that didn't kind of end, it ended a bit off, not the way I wanted it to end at all. So that, by that time, that was when I was completely like done in again, you know, everything. I felt I'd lost everything. I mean, I was reading something the other day and I think, yeah, I actually felt like Job a little bit, like everything had just been suddenly taken away from me. And that's when I kind of went to, started going to therapy. So that'd be about 2017.
Yeah. Wow. So you've been coming through that. So how has it changed your perspective of Christianity or God or how church should be? And how has that evolved? Because obviously you and I have had private conversations, but how's your understanding of Christianity and God and all that now?
So I mean, I've stepped back. I mean, I don't do any ministry. Do you know, I don't do anything that people, like, I don't get involved in the church. I don't go to church meetings. I don't, you know, that, all that kind of institutional side of church. You know, I'll go to services and it's nice and whatever. And but I actually think my relationship with God has become much freer. You know, I mean, there was lots of things that I would feel guilty about, you know, like reading my Bible, for example. I mean, I've probably gone for, this is where I can go into heresy here, you know, 3 or 4 years maybe where I hardly opened my Bible at all because I just couldn't, you know, and at first it was like, oh my goodness, I'm like so guilty about this because, you know, in YWAM you had to have your hours quiet time every day, you know, and that never worked for me. And so I always felt guilty in YWAM because it never worked for me because, you know, my attention span is not going to last for an hour.
It's never worked for me either.
You know, so, and then, so now I'm like, do you know what? It's okay. Don't have to read my Bible, you know. God loves me. And actually, do you know, I've probably read it so much over the years. There's a lot of, it's in here, do you know?
Yeah.
It's in my heart. I don't, you know, and I will read it now,
yeah.
You know. But it's in my heart, you know, and it's a heart thing rather than a kind of, oh my gosh, I've got to read my Bible. Oh my goodness, I haven't prayed.
It's not your daily duty.
It's not my daily duty. Got to tick that off my to-do list for today.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of changed.
Wow.
I think my theology is changing, evolving in lots of different ways. And I think that's kind of come through seeing people maybe who've been hurt by church. And who've been rejected by church for various different reasons. So that's still a kind of work in progress, I think. You know, it's the whole, what is it, the deconstruction. Yeah.
So, I mean, because there's loads of stuff in this. I mean, we could talk for ages, but so much, I'm thinking, like, when all that healing's happening, I mean, did you become a target then? Like, for the healers? Obviously because of your disability.
Yeah, I mean that's been another thing actually that I have very strict boundaries in now because I used to be here's Marisa, oh somebody's got a white cane, let's pray for her because she's got an eyesight problem and I think again well intentioned, but probably I would call out now say spiritual abuse. Because just because I have an eyesight problem doesn't make me, you know, you're right to pray for me for healing. And I've had, you know, I mean, thousands and thousands probably of prayers over the years that I've been in YWAM, in churches, at clan gathering, you know, at healing rooms. And sometimes I would go looking for it and then, you know, nothing happens and then you're disappointed. And the whole kind of, you know, various theologies on it, you know, well, you don't have enough faith if you believe, or, you know, when it doesn't happen, well, you know, God's going to heal you as you go, because that's kind of like a get out clause for the people who's praying. And then, you know, but then it's on you, the onus is on you to keep believing it as you go home and believe it, you know, just like the lepers went off to kind of, you know, as they left Jesus, they got healed, you know, and all these things, you know, scriptures that get thrown at you. I've actually, there's another podcast I really like listening to, is Adam Young, The Place We Find Ourselves. And I read a lot, and he's a psychologist, counsellor. And I've been reading ones, listening to one recently that was Bible verses that were used against you. And I think, you know, a lot of, you know, healing verses have been used against me probably over the years. The whole, did you sin? You know, is there something in your past that you've done? Somebody even told me once that I'd obviously seen something as a child that was highly traumatic, and that is what has caused my eyesight problem. And I was like, right.
So you saw something when you were in the womb that caused you to...
I don't know.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Who knows? That's absolutely crazy.
I
know. I mean, all sorts of things. Oh, and then the other one that I've had as well is... you know, God wants to give you spiritual sight, so he's not going to heal your physical sight. And I'm like, okay, what kind of God is that, you know? And how does that affect other people who've got normal sight? Do you know, do they not have spiritual sight because they've got normal sight, or you only get one or the other, or God's going to kind of punish you for not having one, or he's going to withhold one because that's the kind of God he is? So it was like, I mean, some of it's ridiculous, but that, you know, genuinely is what people have told me over the years. So I got to the stage with that I don't let people pray for me in regard to my eyes. I mean, if I want to, I'll ask. Sure. But if somebody comes up to me and says, can I pray for you for your eyes, I will say no. If they say, can I pray for you, and I say yes, just in a generic kind of way, and they start to pray for my eyes, I will stop the prayer. And I'm not afraid to do that anymore, because I'm like, no, that's not what I want prayer.
Look at you.
That's so cool. We actually, and it, one of the things that kind of struck me was when I was on healing team's ministry actually for a while, the team, and somebody came into our healing rooms for prayer, and he was a blind man, completely blind. So everybody was like, what's the blind man coming in? We're going to pray for his eyes. And I'm like, well, no, ask him what he wants prayer for. We're not going to pray for his eyes. And he wanted prayer for his eczema.
Yeah.
And we prayed for his eczema, and he went away happy. But we didn't pray for his eyes, because I was like, no, it's not what he wants. He doesn't want prayer for his eyes. He wants prayer for his eczema. Do you know?
And it's like an intrusion upon. It's an intrusion, isn't it?
Yeah.
To just assume.
Yeah.
That this is what we need to do, because
somehow we've got to fix people. We've got to fix people. And we can't cope with people if they're broken. Or if they've got something we think needs fixed, we need to kind of fix it. Or, you know, maybe God needs to fix it, but we'll do it for them, you know. But yeah, it's the whole thing of being fixed, I think.
Yeah, it's that assumption, like, you know, isn't it? It's that assumption that something's wrong with you, and I can see it, and I'm going to point it out, and I'm going to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think sometimes that's never about compassion for the broken person or the hurting person or the disabled person. It's usually about me, my spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's the interesting thing.
Yeah. Yeah, somebody in my church recently gave me, lent me a book, which was, it was helpful. I didn't agree with all of it, but it was helpful in part. It's called My Life Is Not a Prayer Request. Mm-hmm. And it was a lady who was in a wheelchair. I'm, you know, encountering this as a Christian, you know, that everybody wanted to pray for her to get healed, and she's like, my life is not a prayer request. And I thought that's just a really good statement, you know, that, you know, my life is not a prayer request, and you don't know what I need prayer for, and, you know, you are crossing boundaries. It is disrespectful to just assume, you know, it's not honouring of people, I don't think. So yeah,
well,
so there's part of my journey.
That's awesome.
I'm getting quite feisty, am I?
Quite right too. I mean, have you found, and this is all-encompassing church missions, the rest of it, did you find that being a woman disadvantaged you in terms of how people saw you? I mean, you're a woman, but then you were also a woman with a health problem.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that disadvantaged you, or did you find that you were treated just the same as other people? Or?
I mean, I don't think it's been a huge problem for me. I mean, I think it's probably one of the good things about YWAM is that they very much embrace women in leadership and women teaching. That's so good. There was always you know, I didn't find, you know, I don't think Wyoming's particularly misogynistic in any way. That's so that was quite good. I mean, obviously, there was the odd time, you know, in churches and things where, you know, that happens. But that's not been, I don't think it's been a huge issue for me. And the church that I go to now, that's church, again, women's pastors, women's deacons. Pastor very much is like, you know, women are equal, have equal rights to men in terms of teaching and leadership and all the rest of it. So I've probably been quite fortunate in that.
That's so good. Yeah. And so you've left ministry and everything else. So what do you do then? How do you live?
So I retrained as an adult literacy tutor a few years ago. Wow. I mean, it was totally God, actually. I kind of met somebody who in the council who worked there, and I was looking just to kind of winding down with Wyoming, but wasn't quite sure if I was leaving or not. And she said, "Oh, do you fancy volunteering as a, you know, as a literacy tutor?" I was like, "Okay, I can do that." So I did the training, lo and behold, Wyoming started to sort of unravel, and church started to unravel. And then a job came up as a literacy tutor. So I went for it. So I just started just one class a week at the time, with adults with sort of various learning disabilities, dyslexia, that kind of thing. And then started doing a German class as well, to speak German. So she said to me, "Oh, do you fancy doing like a conversation class for German?" So, why not, you know? So I did that. And then kind of during lockdown, or even before lockdown, kind of set up a little bit of my own business. So just teaching sort of high school students who are doing like their exams at school, English and German. So I was doing that, but I'm still do that a little bit. I now work as well for just one day a week for Recovery Scotland, which is addiction support and counselling. And I do adult literacy for them. Out in Alloa one day a week. So it's a joint project actually between Recover Scotland and some other charities. They've got some funding to do that, as you do. So I do that one day a week, and then German class. And
it wasn't just school kids that you did the German classes with, was it?
No. Are you alluding to my famous person? Or
yeah.
Yes. So yeah. So I Yes, I've had a few German students. So this one day in my office, this mum came in and said, "My son's looking for some German tutoring. He's just about to turn 16, and he plays for Celtic. So I know you'll kind of he's in the under 18 Celtic squad." And of course, he's just about to turn 16, so he's now going to be kind of up for professional contracts. And he's been kind of basically headhunted by all the big clubs in Europe, and Bayern Munich want to and get him over to their football academy. But he wants to learn some German before he goes. So I had to keep it all silent. I was like, "Hush, hush, you know, we can't let this out because the Celtic hear that they're losing him." Because they wanted him too, but he was going off to Bayern Munich. So yeah, so I ended up teaching him German for 6-7 months.
And he's still there.
He's still there, yeah.
He's still up by him.
He's in the under 21 squads now. He's 19 now.
Yeah.
So he just had his birthday. So, and I said to him at the time, because he was learning his numbers, and he learned some key phrases and stuff. And he learned how to say, I am 16 years old. And I'm like, "You're going to have to learn how to say I am 17, 18, 19, and 20 if you're going to stay in Bayern Munich." So we had to work on his numbers. So I'm hoping that 19, he can say I am 19 years old. In
Germany. Yeah, I'm sure he'll have picked a language up over there as well.
Yeah.
But see, this is
my claim to fame,
But this is what I was saying at the beginning. You've had such an interesting life, you know, like all over the world. Moment.
Yeah,
and tutoring footballers and languages and
I know. And one of the things as well, which, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, yeah, God really uses us, you know, and yeah, we do have a calling in life, you know, and obviously a kind of heart for certain things, and He leads us in certain ways. And my heart's always been for refugees, you know, and that kind of started way back in with Cambodia and stuff. And as I've kind of, you know, in recent years, I mean, traveling is difficult, especially to countries like Cambodia, which, you know, are not going to be set up with, you know, nice kind of streets and sensible driving and all the rest of it.
I've been to Phnom Penh and
and CMB. It's absolutely crazy. So yeah, so it's kind of hard. And so, I mean, that was another thing. I thought, okay, that's dying as well. You know, God's not going to, can't use me anymore. I can't travel anymore. And then, you know, we've had the Syrian war, obviously, well, stuff happening in Sudan. There's Afghanis and now Ukraine. So, you know, it's like, okay, they're coming to me now. So I got involved with the charity locally, Fourth Valley Welcome, which works with the refugees here in Stirling. And so I befriend Syrians. And have become like surrogate auntie to their children, and just an absolute joy. And then last year, obviously, the Ukraine war happened, and I thought, well, I've got a spare room. So I've got a lady staying with me. She kind of stuck her head in earlier. She's just come back from language school. She's learning English just now. So she's been living with me since June last year. So, you know, it's like, you know, God's like, I can still work here.
Wow, that's awesome, Larissa. So, yeah. That's so cool.
I don't have to leave my front door anymore. Do it in my living room.
And you get paid for it now.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, real money. That was a bit of a shock to the system. My people were giving salaries. And then, do you know what? See, in the real world, they give you a wage rise sometimes. It never happened in Lywam. Never happened in my church, really, either, do you know?
Wow. That's so cool.
So, yeah, you actually get paid by the hour now. It's great.
And you're still discovering this love that you were talking about, this father's love. That's still going to, wow. You're living your best life, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Great. And I think it's just, you know, I think it's learned to live much more in the moment, you know, not like, I mean, I remember in Wywams, you know, we used to have these things, what's your 5-year plan? It's like, right, okay, do you know, really?
I've not even got a 5-minute plan.
Well, I was just about to say that. I'm lucky if I know what I'm doing in the next 5 minutes or my 5 years. But I think it is just, you know, okay, you know, take some of that stress off, some of that pressure, the guilt, the, you know, the have to's, the must do's, the ought to's, the should do's, the all those kind of things that we kind of put on ourselves, our church puts on ourselves. And just, okay, what's happening today? Let's see what today will bring. So today is bringing me a podcast, so that's kind of fun.
That's brilliant. Oh, Marissa, we could talk for ages, but I'm going to wind up now and say thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I loved it too. It's been a privilege. Thank you.
It was great, and I'm sure people are going to love you.
Thanks so much.